Hello and welcome to the Sober Mesa podcast. My name is Catherine Howley and my guest this week is Brendan Bonbreason, a researcher specialising in the social and labour history of Catalonia. A particular interest of mine is working class history, especially the trade union and anarcho-syndicalist movement in Barcelona in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. In this episode, I talk to Brendan about how workers' organisation and trade unionism in Barcelona has its roots in medieval guilds, in particular the organisation of journeymen's guilds. Journeyman is a term that comes from medieval guilds and refers to a skilled worker in a building trade or craft who has successfully completed an apprenticeship. The journeyman comes from the French journée, meaning all day, as these workers were paid daily for their labour. Although journeymen's guilds existed throughout Europe, we discuss in this episode how the Catalan context is considered unique in its experience of organisation of workers compared to elsewhere. As always, if you enjoyed the episode, please consider donating to our Buy Me a Coffee page and leave a review or rating where you listen to the podcast. Thank you and enjoy the episode. Hi, Brendan. Many thanks for joining me today. You're very welcome.
Hi, Catherine. Good morning. Thank you for having me. I've been looking forward to this.
So have I. So, Brendan, I think, you know, you've got to this point in your life an academic career that I'm not going to even try and resume it into a few sentences, but really today what I'd love to know more about in particular is the focus that you've had on journeyman guilds in Barcelona and particular expression of these guilds with regard to, you could say, trade unionism, 19th century, 20th century Barcelona, that we can actually take it back centuries and see expressions of workers' organization and trade unionism within these journeyman guilds. But you would just, I need to understand, I suppose, to understand the term or context of what were journeymen guilds and what context did they emerge in Barcelona?
Yes, I guess when we look at what a guild is, start with, we have these associations of master craftsmen. And way back in the 11th or 12th centuries, we see that the master craftsmen of a village would get together. And they would request the right to have a market in their town. And that would give them certain privileges. In the English case, it's very well documented. And I assume something similar happened in Spain. We don't know as much about the early days of the guilds here. But at some time, the master craftsmen for a certain craft would become sufficiently numerous to break away and form their own guild. And a guild is... it is an association of master craftsmen that are granted privileges by the government to regulate their trade and theoretically provide quality control, but also create a ceiling and a floor to economic well-being and advancement. So the idea that they wouldn't want any master to become too poor or to become too rich at the expense of others. And so it's a way of organizing production and labor. And again, it's a time when most of the production is agricultural. The countryside is the most important part of the economy. But at the same time, you're not going to have much of an economy if you don't have urban production of goods and some services. And so the guild would be comprised of the masters at the top, and then in the middle, you would have journeymen. And then at the bottom, you would have the apprentices. And the apprentices and journeymen were considered servants, which is that they worked for the master. The main difference being that the apprentice was not paid in money. Generally speaking, they were paid in food and lodging and perhaps a pair of shoes, two new shirts and a pair of pants every year, something like that. But they would live in the house of the master. They would be expected to be brought up morally and also professionally by the master. And this would generally happen when the boy is 13, 14, 15 years old. And these apprenticeships could last 4, 5, 6, 7 years, sometimes up to 10 years, depending on the craft. What I find particularly interesting is the role of the journeyman. The word journeyman, it has nothing to do with a journey or a traveling, although there are some experiences in that which are very interesting, but it comes from the French. A journée, and a journée refers to a day's labor. A day's labor. And so in Spanish, we still use the term jornada. A jornada is a day's work, or more particularly, the jornal refers to how much you're paid for that day's labor. And so that's where we see the journeymen in the overall economic system. They are the wage earners of that system. And unlike the apprentice, the journeyman is relatively free in that they were allowed to sign contracts for labor, and they were able to search for their own employment. An apprentice was bound to that master. Fleeing a master was a crime if you were an apprentice. And most of the legal process was done by their adult, by their parents, or their guardian. In the case of the journeymen, they were free wage earners, but they were not allowed to open up their own workshop. That was the right of the master, something they guarded very particularly. But it gave the journeyman the opportunity to work for a living. And generally speaking, it was expected that these three stages would correspond to life stages, these three levels of the guild. So you would begin your life as an apprentice. Once your apprenticeship had been completed, they would sign a piece of paper, sure.
And references, like you mentioned, so first step, obviously, was to become an apprentice. That would take 6-7 years, depending on the craft.
Generally speaking, I imagine it would change over time. It's always important when looking at history to understand that things do change over time. But Adam Smith, in his famous treatise on the Wealth of Nations, he talks about the length of time for an apprenticeship, but he favored the Scottish case because their apprenticeships tend to last less time. And he favored a lesser time. There's an argument that the first few years were sort of a cost to the master. You know, they're bungling up the materials. You have to spend a lot of time showing them how to do things properly. But there comes a moment when that apprentice is working as well as a journeyman, and they're actually producing surplus value to their work. They're producing profit for the master. And so it was in the master's interest to keep that journeyman around for a few years at the end to make up for those costs. But generally speaking, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. In Barcelona, for the ordinances that we have or the statutes that we have, they tend to talk about a 4 or 5 year apprenticeship, sometimes a 7 year apprenticeship. And that tends to be pretty common across Europe.
And then after that, become absorbed into the journeyman layer, if you could call it, or strata within the organization.
Exactly. And I would suspect that if you look at sort of modern literature on developing skills, they say it's about 15,000 hours to really master something. Excuse the expression, to really know how to do something properly and to become very good at something, it takes about 15,000 hours of practice. And I would suspect that basically correlates to the apprenticeship period. But then also you would want, you know, if you want the system to last, you want it to be in the interest of the master also to have this person, you know, living in their house, eating at their table, going around their workshop. So you would definitely want some time where that apprentice is actually providing something of value to the master. So you would probably want a few years at the end where the master could make back some of that investment. But in any case, once that apprenticeship is done, then they're considered a journeyman and they were allowed to go and hire themselves out to any of the masters in their city.
Okay, so this is where, I suppose, within the structure strata of apprentice and master, you find in the middle sense of autonomy, really, over, you know, you've to the extent, pardon the pun, mastered the craft. What was the Damien? What meant journeyman unique in Barcelona in comparison to other contexts, or just an idea of what the day-to-day, for example, coppersmith, shoemaker, and what did this look like, this journeyman journey?
Well, the journeyman's work, I think that's common everywhere. You would go to a master and say, hey, I'm willing to work, you know, for this much, you know, this many pounds per year or per week, depending on what sort of contract they want. They could establish a contract that was day labor, weekly or monthly or annual. But it was contracted, and so that they did have certain freedoms in that sense. The journeyman at that point was allowed to live on his own. He no longer had to live in the master's house, because the masters were also expected to teach them to be good Christians, for example, to teach them to be proper people, as it were, sort of a
the moral compass
education.
Yeah,
exactly. And we see that quite clear in some of the literature. But I think the day-to-day life of the journeyman is probably hasn't changed much at all. If you talk to a tradesman nowadays, you know, a plumber, for example, who goes to technical school or does his apprenticeship, as there still are apprenticeships in some places today, once they're a journeyman, they were allowed to hire themselves out to any master. And they would be expected to find a wife during this period also. Some of the guilds would require you to be married before you could become a master. So you generally see a period that's designed to be about 3 or 4 years. In some of the ordinances, they actually specified that they have to do at least 4 years of journeymanship. In some cases, they actually say there's two different phases of journeyman, where during the first 2 or 3 years, they could be a journeyman, but they would still live in the house of the master, still eat at his table. The actual phrase is he would eat at their table, but they would still be paid in coin. But there would still sort of be this transitional period from a real patriarchal system of the apprenticeship, where they, you know, the master could eat the apprentice as though he were his father. They were really basically in loco parentis, in place of the parents. But once it was a journeyman, yeah, you're dealing with an adult. You know, you're dealing with a man who has certain rights.
I suppose to this point, I've got a sense of the individual progressing from apprentice. As you said, it could happen at different stages, that kind of liberation, so to speak, from the structure of being in the master's home, eating at the table. To what extent was this individual, I mean, because your research, your focus is interested in trade unionism, and that kind of seems like a more collective workers approach.
Yes.
Where do we find that in particular with the expression of journeyman guilds in Barcelona?
That's exactly it. Quite frankly, and that's what makes the guilds in Barcelona special. Generally speaking, throughout Europe and eventually North America, it was illegal for the journeyman to organize. It's called combination. It's a type of conspiracy. And the powerful and the rich did not want the journeymen to organize because they knew that they would organize for their betterment. They would try to decrease their hours and raise their wages. But in Barcelona, after the War of Spanish Secession that ended in 1714 in Barcelona, 1715 in the Balearic Islands, but generally people date the end of the war to 1714, you have the Bourbons come in from France, and they beat the Habsburgs. And so you have a transition of government, and you have a new government. And we're still not sure. We're rather relatively early in the research dedicated to these journeyman guilds. But my hypothesis is that the Bourbons were trying to punish Barcelona. There were a number of measures against Catalonia because Catalonia supported the Habsburg and resisted the Bourbons. Until half the city was blown away and they were forced to succumb to the new order. And they were punished. Importantly, the city had been run by the Council of 100, Once de Cent. And that's still, if you walk into the mayor's office now, they still have the council chamber. And you can still see these fantastic wooden chairs. They look like wooden thrones. And carved into each chair was a guild symbol, because the guilds made up a significant part of this council. And part of the reforms were to eliminate the power of that council.
So just to contact the council, I believe it began in the 12th century. So we're going right up to the 18th century now, but just to give a context again of how unique this was in the context of Greater Europe, the Council of 100.
As far as the numbers go, it might be. I know that Florence, for example, the guilds had some role in the municipal government. I think that was part of sort of this early bourgeois move for power. Bourgeoisie meaning a burgher, mm-hmm, in German, someone of the city. And the bourgeoisie were the craft masters. They were the ones that were allowed to vote in elections. They could hold office. That was one of the freedoms of being a master. But in any case, in Barcelona, they were the functional government for this city and the outlying area, but particularly in the city. And after 1714, you have the decrees of the Nova Planta. I don't even really know how to translate that in English. You'll have to excuse me. I generally do all this work in Spanish, so there are a few things I don't know how to translate, but it was a whole set of new laws that, for example, they began to use Castilian or Spanish in the legal system as opposed to Catalan. And it was really sort of a centralizing nation state building, a nation referring to the Spanish nation. In the 17th century, then the term nation is defined in a wonderful French dictionary as coming from Latin for natio. And a natio is a Latin term referring to a litter of puppies, sort of going back to that Roman idea that they were all brought up by wolves, lupa. And so a nation is a litter of puppies, which is to say a people with very common traits, and most importantly, perhaps a common language. And so the Castilian replaces the Catalan because they're trying to create Spain. They're reaffirming this construction of a nation state built on a people. And so part of that was replacing the language and replacing the institutions. And when it comes to labor, for some reason, they thought it would be best to perhaps keep those bourgeois masters in check by allowing the journeymen to form legally recognized guilds of their own.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Previous to this, we have what's called a confraternity, which is generally a religious-based organization for mutual aid. So they're sort of like insurance schemes by the workers. The masters had their confraternities, and they would sometimes allow the journeymen to join, or they would require them to join. But in the early 16th century, we have some of these journeymen forming their own independent confraternities. And this was not uncommon in Europe. But generally speaking, as soon as that confraternity began to talk about labor issues, they were put in place. They were repressed to some degree or another. But in Spain in the 18th century, we see these confraternities transitioning into gremios or guilds of journeymen, and that's very unusual. Generally, as I said, it was illegal. It was a crime of conspiracy. In the English case, they were repressed very significantly. Anytime they wanted to form or their club began to discuss labor issues, it was considered a crime of conspiracy. It was against the public order. And of course, the wealthy masters had the support of the authorities, or they were themselves the authorities. And so what we have is a lovely situation in Barcelona where we have legal documents that show how these journeymen guilds operated. And we also see a sort of a labor relations system by which they didn't have to just go to a strike. They didn't have to do sabotage or work slowdowns or refuse to sell their labor to the masters. They could take them to court. And so throughout the rest of Europe, excepting Italy, I must say, throughout the rest of Europe, the journeymen would have to struggle in clandestine fashion. It was an illegal operation from the very beginning. The fact that they were organized was illegal. And so all of their actions that were derived from that were also illegal. But in Barcelona, we have these journeymen guilds. And what this allows us to show is what they were interested in changing about their work. And to no surprise, they wanted to maintain a monopoly over labor, just as any trade union would want now. They would want what we call a closed shop. They would want to make sure that every carpenter in the city belongs to the Carpenters Guild, and that they would respect the terms and conditions established by the guild. And so we have this negotiation of labor by legally recognized corporations. These are bodies, corporations formed of the workers. And we have this negotiated process here.
And with regards to those negotiations, I'm sure it's documented, you said, you know, of the challenge sometimes to follow the path of the organization, expressions of organizations, because of lack of documentation. But do you have, and have you found in your research, particular examples of processes?
Yes.
1714, whereby the organization could be seen, journeymen guilds, as progressing in labor rights, even though it wasn't called that at the time?
Yeah, I'm sure that they had some sort of way of referring to labor rights. I mean, these are still race-based societies, but we haven't been able to identify the exact moment when they transitioned from confraternity to guild. Okay. But there's a point, I would say, in the 1740s, 1750s at the latest, when some of the earliest guilds of journeymen began to arise. And in a lot of ways, they just copied the tried and true method and structure of the masters' guilds, which was referred to as little workers' republics, even when it was the masters, because they were democratic structures. In fact, some of the only form of democracy in the late medieval period was through these guilds, because the masters would come together and they would elect their own officers. They would elect generally two directors and a treasurer, a secretary, and what they would call a seeker in English, one who would go from house to house to make sure that a sick master was actually sick. If he needed anything, they would go to the workshops to make sure that they weren't hoarding materials, that they didn't have too many apprentices, that they weren't violating the guild's rules. They would have a seeker who would go and do these things. And so when the journeymen began their guilds, they did the same thing. They would have a general assembly that would meet at least annually in ordinary session, and they would review the expenses. The treasurer would make a presentation of the expenses and the income, settle the books, and they would elect their two directors and their treasurer and also their own seekers. But in the case of the journeymen, these seekers would go to the workshops of the masters and make sure that the journeymen employed there had paid their dues. And they would use a papeleta, or a paper, what we would sort of think of as a union book. And that would have the journeyman's name in it, and it would show that he had paid his dues to the journeyman's guilds, which is to say that it's very clear they wanted to operate a closed shop, that everyone in the city, every carpenter in the city, was a journeyman guild member, that he paid his dues, and he was therefore allowed to work. Sometimes the monopoly was legal, sometimes it was sort of a de facto monopoly, but generally speaking, it was very clear that they wanted to make sure that every worker in the city was organized. And so during the second half of the 18th century, we see a number of trades that had these guilds operating, and they were in pretty important sectors of the economy. I mentioned the carpenters, bricklayers, and quarry workers. We have the tailors, shoemakers, bread makers. So these are very important parts of the economy. And they were trying to create a closed shop across this. And if you compare it to nowadays, where generally union membership, I think, rarely goes above 20 or 30% in modern economy. So I think they were actually arguably more successful during that period. And this allowed them to sort of argue on behalf of the workers to further limit the number of apprentices that could be hired, because apprentices, again, were seen as cheap labor. And also to assure that the masters were not hiring people from outside the city. That was a very big consideration. The idea of a farmer coming into the city and working cheaper than a city dweller was a general concern. But we can definitely see that in their statutes, they refer to themselves as guilds. And interestingly, they begin to develop or express a class consciousness. And again, this is a little more controversial, but there's a wonderful document where the shoemakers, the German shoemakers, say, "Somos de la clase de mancebos zapateros." We are from the class of journeyman shoemakers. And so they were perfectly conscious that this is a stratified society of capitalists and workers. The capitalist, in this case, being the master, he had capital. He had money that could be invested in other workers.
And would that be one of the first examples of seeing class being mentioned by guild members, journeyman guild members?
Certainly, to my understanding, in Barcelona. And again, I think that it's important because it underscores this idea that we've always had classes. It's not just I think in most history classes nowadays, they sort of equate industrialization with the formation of class and class consciousness. But there have always been classes. It's just that those classes change over time. And what we consider to be the determining class, the class that determines the flow of history in the Marxist sense, that changes over time. But in the 18th century, this is prior to industrialization. Mm-hmm. Spain didn't get its first steam-powered engine until the 1830s. It didn't last long. It was destroyed in a rebellion in 80. But they were definitely moving in that direction. In the English case at this time, there's a wonderful author, R.A. Leeson, and he has a great book called Traveling Brothers, and he describes how the journeymen in England had to organize these clubs based on a circuit, a work circuit, sort of like the Tour de France is a worker's circuit, so that when they needed work and there wasn't work in one city, they would go to the next town and they would spend the night. They would be offered, I think it was, two beers and a rabbit. They would be given a place to sleep, and in the morning they would be taken to a workshop and they would be put to work. And if they could work well and there was an opportunity, they would be hired. And if not, their book would be stamped and they would be given a few coins to make it to the next town. And once they arrived at the next town, they would look for the tavern, you know, the carpenter's arms, as it were, and repeat the process.
And of course, in the case of Barcelona, this wasn't necessary because it was regulated. The fact that you joined a journeyman guild, or what the journeyman guild, I believe what you're saying, what I understand is it was this structure that allowed for kind of a monitoring of supply and demand. Services within the city, we need X amount of workers. We're not going to outsource cheaper labor. We're going to protect those who have gone through the artisan process.
Yes, I think we still need to better understand why they didn't develop these traveling networks in Catalonia. It's something. It's one of the questions that remains, because we do have traveling networks. That the Germans were very famous for their traveling networks. It was a requirement that at the end of the apprenticeship or the early part of the journeymanship, they would have to travel. And again, I don't want to confuse the journey.
Yes,
but it's inevitable, unfortunately. But these sort of worker circuits were very important, at least culturally. They probably, in the French case, they have what they're called compagnons, and the compagnons are these journeyman networks, and they would have their houses where there would be a mother and a father, like an older couple that would rent out a space to the journeyman. They would go and eat there, and some of them would have interesting names like the gluttons. You know, because food and drink was an important part of that experience. In England, Leeson says that 1/3 of their rules and 1/3 of their money was dedicated to drinking together. Drinking was a very important part of that journeyman experience. And I don't think we see that in Barcelona. We see a much more orderly, structurally domesticated association.
Disciplined.
We're not exactly... Yeah. And we're not really sure why the labor market was such that they didn't develop a traveling network, or at least we've never found evidence of a traveling network. But there's a wonderful example of a journeyman guild in the nearby city of Tarragona, which is just down the coast from Barcelona, sort of a second tier city. And there was only one journeyman guild, and it comprised the journeymen of all of the trades. So it's sort of hearkening back to those very early days in the 10th and 11th century where all the masters would get together, regardless of their trade, to create a single merchant's guild. And then that would transition into a specific trade. So the goldsmiths would move out, maybe taking the silversmiths with them, and then they would form their own guild. But in Tarragona, probably because it was a smaller population, they only had one journeyman guild. And what's fascinating about that guild is they reserved half of the leadership positions and half of the membership of the council to outsiders, to foreigners, to forasteros. In this context, the foreigner was someone from outside of the city of Tarragona. During the Middle Ages, everything was based around the city. But as we see this progression over time, you have the creation of a national labor market, which is to say you no longer had to have done your apprenticeship in Barcelona to be allowed to work in Barcelona. That was actually the main reason for the first laws against the guilds in 1808 with the Statutes of Bayonne, which were imposed by the Napoleonic forces. And then in 1813, the Constitution of the first Spanish Constitution, the Constitution of 1812, that the government that put that in place was they were the last holdouts against the Napoleonic forces during the Napoleonic Wars, the Peninsular War, and they also created the freedom to move from city to city and the freedom for anyone to invest in industry. So you have this creation of a national labor market, and the guilds, I think, fought against this. But in Tarragona, they took a different approach. They said, "No, you." We understand people are going to come in from the countryside, so that's fine. Just play by our rules, and we're going to give you half of the leadership positions, which I think is incredibly fascinating, but also rather progressive, if we could apply a term to that period, because they knew that they needed to somehow resolve this issue. And again, it speaks to this idea of a legalistic, an orderly approach. They weren't standing by in the English case, that if the journeyman called a strike, in the city, if they said all the carpenters were going to strike against all the masters in the town, the journeyman would refuse to work. And then They wouldn't stay at home. They wouldn't go to the tavern. They would go to the edge of town by the roads, and they would tear up pickets from the picket fence. That's where we get the term picket. It wasn't holding a sign. It was holding a stick to beat the blackleg or the scab who was going to break the strike. But in Catalonia, Aragon is part of Catalonia. We see an orderly rebellion, an orderly process, because they could just take them. They could take the masters to court and say, "Hey, you're violating the statutes."
I mean, this seems because I believe it's not long after that the guilds are eventually abolished.
That's correct. The first attempt to limit or abolish the guilds in a significant way was that 1813 measure. But in 1815, the absolutist, the Spanish king, is replaced. The French troops are expelled, and things went back to normal. And the guilds were reestablished. They were given their monopoly privileges. But you have a process where the Spanish crown began to try to limit the degree of monopoly. And this meant they would require the guilds to resubmit their statutes for royal approval, because these statutes were all by royal or municipal approval. And it granted them the authority of law, the weight of law, to operate in the city, within the walls of the city. And so we have a process where everyone knew that economic change was in the air. I mean, the English had been advancing in industrialization for quite some time, the French also. The Spanish had resisted this because they wanted to protect their industries. But I think they began to realize, at least the what we would consider the bourgeois capitalists, petty nobles and those that wanted to become involved in the industrial process, they wanted to buy steam engines. But to import a steam engine, you had to get royal approval because there was still a protectionist economic policies. But there's in 1820, you have a constitutional rebellion. A new government is put in place. The king flees, and that lasted for 3 to 4 years. And then during this period, the guilds were abolished again. And at that period, it's interesting because the workers said, okay, well, if we can't have guilds, then let's have brotherhoods. And they might not enjoy the same legal status, but they still were desirous of organizing. They knew that an organized life was better for the workers. And I think to a degree, the municipal governments also recognized that a degree of order was also beneficial to society. After this constitutional period ends, King Fernando VII comes back in. He begins a decade of pretty fierce repression, the ominous decade, as it's called in Spanish literature. And that lasted until his death in 1833. When he died, the state or the crown was already in the process of, reducing the monopolistic privileges, but they wanted to create a unified structure for all of the guilds in the country. And they created a single document that was to be filled out by each guild so that all of their statutes, all of their rules would be basically the same. And in that document, they talk about how it's in the state's interest that workers be organized as a means of social control. And this basically came to an end with his death. And you have the Carlist War because of the struggle for secession. He died without a son, without a male heir. And there was the liberals were in favor of allowing his daughter to take power under the regency. And the more conservative elements, supported by the Catholic Church, preferred his brother, Carlos, to take over. So you have the first Carlist War. And the Carlist as an idea would be present in Spanish society until the Spanish Civil War. The Carlists, the Carlist elements still fought in the Spanish Civil War. And so you have a civil war in Spain, and the liberal elements that were in favor of industrialization, in favor of abolishing the guilds, they came to power. And in 1834, they passed a measure to significantly reduce the power of the guilds. It was no longer obligatory to join the guilds, but it still wasn't enough. The guilds continued to operate. But in 1836, as the war was getting worse, and after violent rebellions in 1835, they decided to abolish the guilds. And the 1836 abolition was definitive. It should be noted that this was only applied to the manual trades. The what were called the liberal professions were allowed to keep their colleges. So the doctors, the engineers, the architects, this sort of higher strata for workers, if you may, they were allowed to continue their organizations, and they persist to this day. And they still have those guild powers. If you're not an architect and a member of the architect college, you can't practice. And so when they say that the guilds were abolished, it's very important to keep in mind that only one part of society was forbidden from organizing.
And that was essentially the side that was going to become industrialized, you know, mass production of...
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. It was seen as necessary to open the way for industrialization because the guilds limited the number of employees you could have. The masters wanted to limit it so that no master could become more wealthy or powerful than the other masters. And the journeymen also, I think, were concerned at making sure that there wasn't a flood of unqualified labor that would reduce their value in the marketplace. But if you have a factory, you don't need that skill. You know, you have one job, and your job is to work the loom, and they could get by with less qualified workers. Interestingly, in the early parts of industrialization, they were still hiring journeymen because you did need some skill. You had to understand the processes overall, but then that journeyman could hire his own workers and pay them. So sort of a subcontracting system in the very beginning. Regardless, in 1836, you do have this abolition, and the guilds of masters were their houses were their guild halls were appropriated, their funds were appropriated by the state, and they were basically repressed. And the same applied to the journeyman guilds. And so you have a period when the workers say, okay, well, you know, we've been through this before. If we're not allowed to have guilds, we need something else. And what they formed were mutual aid societies on one hand, and that's a clear continuity of the confraternity. These are sort of insurance schemes. So if you were sick or injured, or if you pass away, they would provide money to your family, sort of an insurance scheme. And in some cases, these were used as resistance organizations. So they continue to function in the spheres of labor, in the spheres of work, trying to decrease hours and increase wages. But we also have the creation of worker societies, sociedades obreras. And these were dedicated to labor issues. And we see that the trades that had previously operated as journeymen guilds very quickly formed worker societies. And they actually organized a council in Barcelona to coordinate across the trades, which is a trades council, which is, again, a very interesting moment in labor history here in the city. And these associations were basically allowed to operate freely until 1843. And in 1843, the moderate party came to power and repressed all these forms of association. It's a very liberal party, and the liberals, again, were very interested in eliminating worker organization and guild organization. And they entered a dark period of about 25 years. And we wouldn't see associations legally operating until 1868, when you have the Glorious Revolution, when the queen was dethroned, or she fled, and basically they have a new moment, a new government is brought in. You have an Italian king is brought in, it doesn't go well, and you have the Declaration of the First Republic. But in 1868, the freedom of assembly and association was created. And the workers of Barcelona reacted immediately. Within a few months of the revolution in September, they formed the first workers' congress in Barcelona, and that brought together the workers of a great number of trades. And what we see is that these we have industrial trades, especially in the textile sector, that didn't have as much of a guild tradition, mixing with workers who had come from that guild tradition. There's a wonderful quote, and it says, the Society of Journeymen Carpenters of Barcelona dates to the year 1840. From the year 40 to the year 68,
it has suffered a bad interregnum owing to the moderate governments that have oppressed us. An interregnum being a period of disorder, referring to their clandestine existence. But what it means is that we have these workers that had been brought up in the guild tradition, in the guild system, with the journeyman guilds, operating openly again in the foundation of the Workers' Congress. And the Workers' Congress would go on to provide the foundation for the Spanish participation in the First International Work Humans Association, the Internationale. And so we see this very interesting development, this trajectory that goes all the way from these medieval guilds all the way up until the period of Marxism and anarchism, which is, I think, when most industrial labor historians start to pay attention. But they tend to overlook that background. And so that's really where the research is now, is looking at this foundational experience of workers for industrialization, really lay the groundwork and operate it as trade unions. I think the best definition of a trade union that's still used today is from the Webbs, Sidney and Beatrice Webbs, English historians, who wrote at the end of the 19th century. They said, a trade union, as we understood the term, is a continuous association of wage earners for the purpose of maintaining and improving the conditions of non-employment. And we can see that the journeyman guilds clearly met this criteria in the late 18th century. And so it allows us, or it forces us to push back the clock and to go much further into history to see where workers were able to organize and what they tried to do and how the state responded to it, and sort of the strategies and motivations of all sides. But we see this very, very rich history beginning to come out of the archival papers of these associations that predate the mutual aid societies. They predate these workers' societies, and they certainly predate industrial unionism and anarcho-syndicalism, which would carry forward all the way up to the Spanish Civil War and to today to a degree.
I suppose a deeper understanding as well of why you've got one of the biggest trade union movements, or particularly anarcho-syndicalist movements, comparably in world history, was in Catalonia.
I definitely am. One of the most famous anarchists, Anselmo Lorenzo, who was at the international meetings, or some of them in England, he wrote, I don't have the quote on hand, but he talks about how the workers of Barcelona had a long history of organizing from 1840. He specifically mentions 1840s. And so it takes us directly to this moment where the journeyman guilds transitioned into worker societies, and they sort of, marched forward into their working class movement hand in hand with the unions in the textile industry. Textiles are fundamentally important because that's where the concentration of labor first occurred. You have these, or at least on a grand scale, you have, hundreds or thousands of workers in these factories. And that there's that quote that's attributed to Napoleon that says, quantity has a quality all its own. And while I'm a big fan of that, I think we would be miss to overlook the fact that quality has a quality all its own. And you don't need to have great numbers of people in an organization to develop these practices. That said, around 1800 or so, you have hundreds of journeyman carpenters, 600, 800 carpenters, you have shoemakers. These were not insignificant trades by any means. And so we definitely have these very rich examples of labor struggle within a legal system. And I think that's the great difference between the Spanish and the Northern European and English cases, is that these weren't clandestine organizations, which allows us to trace their struggles through legal documents and court cases, as opposed to police reports, which is generally the English system.
It feels like,
the sources say a lot.
Well, on the topic of sources, just for listeners and even for my own personal interest, I mean, there's obviously a distinct lack of reference. We've got a few facades, the Coppersmiths Guildhall facade, the Shoemakers Guildhall facade, not in their original locations. They were both moved at different stages down to Plaza San Felip Neri. If, for those with interest in this topic, where is the best place to find out more, to follow this in Barcelona?
It's interesting because the masters guilds would have their guild halls. I mean, they had a lot more money, to be honest. And
even if you compare the Spanish guild halls, like the Catalan guild halls, to those that you would see in, let's say, the Netherlands or the Low Countries or Belgium, or in London, these were not nearly as majestic. They just weren't. But you would still have buildings that were owned by the guilds. I don't think we have evidence of that in the journeyman guilds necessarily. I think they met in more humble circumstances, but I don't think they had that extra money to invest in property, to have a guild hall. Perhaps they didn't need it. They were able to meet in other locations. Unfortunately, we haven't localized those spots yet. So it's sort of an invisible part of the history, at least from an urbanistic or architectural sense. Honestly, if you want to see it, you have to go to the archives. That's basically where it is, unfortunately. And I think that's the same could be said for a lot of the other worker societies or the mutual aid societies. They weren't investing or spending their money on these great structures, but they also didn't have centuries to collect that money.
Of course,
no, yeah. They weren't, and they came about at a time, I think, where real estate was becoming more expensive. There were a great population boom in Barcelona, throughout Catalonia, and you have the urbanization of Barcelona in the 18th century. And so I think that they just they weren't interested in that, I would say, or if they were interested, they weren't able to, or perhaps we just don't know where they were. Even the most humble guilds of like the sailors guilds, for example, they would have a guild hall, but it's nothing when compared to guild hall of the masters. It's much more of a one or two story house that would allow them to keep their papers in order, or they would have a shack in the harbor where they would keep their boats and their papers and, perhaps their treasury, their safe was held at the master, the director's house, for example, under three keys so that he couldn't steal. But I think in the case of the journeyman's guilds, we don't know. And I don't think we will know, unfortunately. But if we do, I'll be sure to tell you so you can take a tour.
Well, thank you very much. That was really interesting. And all the best with your research. I think you are involved in a few different publications, chapters of books.
Yes, that's the phase we're at now, is having done most of the research, having gone, spent the hours in the archives, reading the literature that other people, other historians have written on the topic. It's interesting because these journeyman guilds are not unknown to Catalan historians, but I don't think they gave it the attention it deserves. I don't think that they recognize how unique this experience is in the European context. And unfortunately, since most of the literature is in Spanish and Catalan, I don't think it's been read very widely in the north of Europe. And so I find myself in the envious position of being able to delve into that very deeply and publish in English. And so we'll be sharing this research at a number of congresses and hopefully a few publications in the year or 2 years to come. We're definitely looking forward to that.
Well, fantastic. Well, thanks so much for joining me today, Brendan.
No, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure. Really appreciate
it. Thank you.